Glass Animals, Heat Waves. We also heard Miley Cyrus.
Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower. And our stories are written especially for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. First, Dan Friedel brings us the education report. I will return with this week's words and their stories. Today, we talk about starting off right. On the right foot. We will finish our 30 minutes together with The Making of a Nation, our ongoing U.S. history program. But first, the education report.
It's official. Howard University, announced on Twitter as Kamala Harris, took the oath of office as Vice President of the United States on January 20th, earlier this year. Right away, Harris became Howard's best-known graduate, passing even Thurgood Marshall, the first Black Supreme Court justice. Harris graduated in 1986. Marshall received his law degree in 1934. Howard is one of about 100 historically Black colleges and universities, known as HBCUs, in the U.S. HBCUs started in the late 1800s, so Black Americans could go to college at a time when many universities did not accept them. Howard, about 3 kilometers from the White House, was founded in 1867. Its long list of famous graduates includes Nobel Prize winner Toni Morrison and actors Chadwick Boseman and Felicia Rashad. Boseman starred in several recent Hollywood movies, including Black Panther. Boseman, just 43, died of cancer last August. Rashad graduated in 1970. She became famous as Claire Huxtable in the popular television series The Cosby Show. For most universities, having a graduate as the first female U.S. vice president would be the year's most important moment. But for Howard, the news kept getting better. In May, Rashad returned to the university to be the leader of the College of Fine Arts. And in July, 2 important Black writers, Ta-Nehisi Coates and Nicole Hannah Jones, accepted long-term teaching positions at Howard. Ta-Nehisi Coates won the National Book Award for Between the World and Me. Hannah Jones won the Pulitzer Prize as the creator of the New York Times' 1619 Project. Both could have gone to teach at any university, but they chose Howard. Hannah Jones said she wanted to be at a school where she would be welcomed and not just tolerated. The moves signaled Howard's plan to become more than just a college for Black Americans. It wants to be a place where the nation's leading scholars and thinkers come to teach. The buzz has been fantastic, said Anthony Wuto, about the 3 new professors. He is the school's provost and a Howard graduate. The provost is one of a university's top leaders. Wuto said the hires are part of Howard's recent improvement plan. Black students always saw Howard as a great place to study, make lifelong friendships, and take leadership roles in student organizations. Even Harris, who ran and won the offices of Attorney General and U.S. Senator in California, says the most difficult political race she ever ran was for a position on the school's student council. It's not just politics, arts, journalism, and medicine that is causing people to think more about Howard. The school's sports teams are also getting some attention. Once the football and basketball teams at major universities in Texas, Alabama, and Georgia accepted black student players in the 1960s, some of the best stopped going to HBCUs like Howard. Just recently, NBA basketball star Steph Curry gave Howard $3 million to support its golf team. And Makur Maker, a basketball player from South Sudan, who mostly grew up in Australia, became one of the highest-rated players to join Howard in many years. He had considered strong college basketball teams, including UCLA, Kentucky, and Memphis, before choosing Howard. Jonathan Roan will start his final year at Howard later this month. The chemical engineering student grew up in Atlanta, Georgia. Although his parents met at Howard, he was not sure if he wanted to go there. At one point, he thought he would go to the University of Colorado. But after 3 years, he is happy about his choice.
One thing that's useful is that you get to focus more on your actual experience rather than focusing on a lot of external factors, like worrying if you're going to be fitting in socially.
Roan added that he met a lot of people at Howard who are living proof that you can go to an HBCU and have a very, very successful life. Roan observed that Howard's president, Dr. Wayne Frederick, has been aggressive in spreading the word about Howard, especially its graduate programs, such as the medical school. Frederick worked as a cancer surgeon before taking the leadership role at Howard. Janelle Johnson will start her second year at Howard after a year of learning from home in Florida because of COVID-19 restrictions. She said she is excited to meet other students and professors in person, but she is perhaps most excited about joining a large black community in Washington. Inside Higher Ed is a publication that centers on colleges and universities in the U.S. It calls 2021 a breakthrough year for many HBCUs in terms of drawing new students. At Howard, Wuto said, the school is also drawing international students from Africa, the Caribbean, and, surprisingly, Nepal. Last year, Howard received a $40 million donation from Mackenzie Scott, the largest gift from a single donor in the school's history. Scott is the former wife of Amazon founder Jeff Bezos and a former student of Howard graduate Toni Morrison. Recently, it received $20 million from several foundations and another donor. But more is needed, as HBCUs like Howard were ignored for many years. Wuto said the school uses donations to reduce tuition, but it could not give money, known as a scholarship, to every student who is qualified. and the school has not been able to build new buildings and research centers. You know, we're not endowed the way a Harvard or Yale or Johns Hopkins is, Wuto said. We have students who are just as capable and exceptional, and we need to be able to find ways to provide support to them. I'm Dan Friedel.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Today, we talk about something that you might take for granted. You might not think about them or appreciate their value and worth. Your feet. We just expect them to be there when we need them. But our feet are very important, and they have managed to walk right in to many English expressions. Let's talk about some. First, let's put our best foot forward. This means you act in the best possible way to show your best possible self. Sometimes we do this to impress others. But sometimes we just want to do the best job we can, or be the best person we can. At work, people who put their best foot forward work fast and do the job well. Here's another foot expression, to start off on the right foot. If something starts off on the right foot, it means it starts off in a good way. For example, you can start your day off on the right foot. You can start a class off on the right foot. If you start or get off on the right foot, you immediately have success when you begin an activity, a project, a job, or even a relationship. For example, when you are starting a new job, you want to start off on the right foot with your new coworkers. And if you have a new boyfriend or girlfriend, you really want to start off on the right foot with their parents. Maybe you just met a new friend. You also want to get off on the right foot with their group of friends. All of this means that you want to leave a good impression, especially when you first meet. In fact, we have a special saying about that. You don't get a second chance to make a first impression. If you make a bad first impression, you have started off on the wrong foot. And it is harder to repair relationships when they start off poorly. Also, it is harder to get a project back on track if it started on the wrong foot. Some word experts say that ancient superstitions thought that the right foot was luckier than the left. So it was good luck to start off with the right foot instead of the left. Now let's hear two friends use some of these expressions.
Wow, you look great. Is that a new business suit?
No, I've had this suit for years, but I think I've gained some weight during the pandemic.
Well, it does look a little tight. Maybe try unbuttoning the jacket.
Good idea.
Your haircut looks great, too. So, where are you going all dressed up?
Today I start a new job, in a new office, with new people.
That's a big deal. I mean, we've all been working from home for more than a year.
Tell me about it. It feels strange to wear a suit. But with my new job, I really want to start off on the right foot. You know what they say, you don't get a second chance to make a first impression.
In that case, maybe you should wear real shoes. It's hard to put your best foot forward wearing your house slippers.
Oh no, I'm wearing slippers. I have to go all the way back home and get my shoes. Now I'll be late.
Looks like you have to choose. Start off on the wrong foot by showing up late or by wearing slippers.
You know, maybe no one will notice my footwear, but my boss will definitely notice if I'm late. So I guess slippers it is.
Just stay at your desk as much as you can. Good luck.
Thanks. See you later. Hopefully, you started your day off on the right foot with some English lessons from VOA Learning English. And that's all the time we have for this Words in Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
Today on The Making of a Nation, we continue the story of the American Revolution. Here is Steve Ember.
The year was 1775. Colonists in Massachusetts had fought battles with British troops in the towns of Lexington and Concord. War had not been declared, but citizen soldiers in each of the 13 American colonies were ready to fight. Who was going to organize the colonists into an army? This was the first question that faced the Second Continental Congress when delegates met in May in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The delegates decided that the man for the job was George Washington. He had experience fighting in the French and Indian War. He seemed to know more than any other colonist about being a military commander. The delegates elected him as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army. He accepted the position, but said he would not take any money for leading the new army. George Washington left Philadelphia for Massachusetts, where he took command on July 3rd, 1775.
He was tall, he was very elegant, very well put together.
Jane Gordon at the Massachusetts Historical Society says Washington looked very impressive.
It's very interesting because when he came to take command of the Continental Army, many of the New England soldiers were not quite sure what to make of this man who was, after all, from Virginia, not from New England. Washington won them over. His conduct, his grace, I think his discipline was extremely important.
Back in Philadelphia, the delegates to the Second Continental Congress made one more attempt to prevent war with Great Britain. They sent another message to King George. They asked him to consider their problems and try to find a solution. The king would not even read the message. You might wonder, why would the delegates try to prevent war if the people were ready to fight? The answer is that most of the members of the Congress and most of the colonists were not yet ready to break away from England. They continued to believe they could have greater self-government and still be part of the British Empire. Jane Gordon at the Massachusetts Historical Society says many colonists felt conflicted and confused about their identity.
They're Englishmen, they're still Englishmen, but they're not Englishmen. All along, what they've wanted is just to have the rights of Englishmen, and it doesn't seem to be possible under an old system.
A major battle took place in June of 1775, just 2 days after the delegates in Philadelphia chose George Washington as commander. It was the first major battle of the American Revolution. It was called the Battle of Bunker Hill, although it really involved two hills, Bunker and Breeds. Both are just across the Charles River from the city of Boston. Massachusetts soldiers dug positions on Breeds Hill. The British started to attack from across the river. The Americans had very little gunpowder. They were forced to wait until the British had crossed the river and were almost on top of them before they fired their guns. Their commander reportedly told them not to fire on the British until they saw the whites of their eyes. The British climbed the hill. The Americans fired. A second group of British soldiers climbed the hill. The Americans fired again. The third time, the British reached the top, but the Americans were gone. They had left because they had no more gunpowder. Peter Drummey, a librarian at the Massachusetts Historical Society, reads part of a letter that a young soldier wrote to his mother.
I was in the fort when the enemy came in, jumped over the wall, and ran half a mile, where balls, that is, musket balls, flew like hailstones and cannon roared like thunder.
The British captured Breed's Hill, but Peter Drummey says the Americans still considered the battle a kind of victory.
The paradox is, even though the American forces are defeated and forced off the hill, nevertheless, the British casualties are so high that it is at least a moral victory.
Even the young American soldier who fled the battle wrote to his mother that he would continue fighting for American independence.
And in fact, that's probably what the British learned from this battle, that they could capture this hill at great cost, but the New England countryside is full of hills, and they couldn't capture them all back.
That battle also reduced whatever hope was left for a negotiated settlement. King George declared the colonies to be in open rebellion. The American colonists fought several battles against British troops in 1775. Yet, the colonists were still not ready to declare war. Then, the following year, the British decided to use Hessian soldiers to fight against the colonists. Hessians were mostly German mercenaries who fought for anyone who paid them. The colonists feared these soldiers and hated the British for using them. In January of 1776, Thomas Paine published a document that strongly influenced the colonists. He named the pamphlet Common Sense. It attacked King George as well as the idea of a monarchy, a government led by a king or queen. The pamphlet called for independence. About 150,000 copies of Common Sense were sold in the colonies. Everyone talked about it. As a result, the Second Continental Congress began to act. It opened American ports to foreign shipping. It urged colonists to establish state governments and to write constitutions. On June 7, 1776, Virginia delegate Richard Henry Lee proposed a resolution for independence. The resolution was not approved immediately. Declaring independence was an extremely serious step. Signing such a document would make the delegates traitors to Britain. They would be killed if captured by the British. The delegates wanted the world to understand what they were doing and why. So they appointed a committee to write a document giving the reasons for their actions. One member of this committee was Thomas Jefferson of Virginia. He had already written a report criticizing the monarchy, so the other committee members asked him to write the new document. They said he was the best writer in the group. They were right. Jefferson was 33 years old. It took him 17 days to write the document. The Second Continental Congress approved it on July 4, 1776. It was America's Declaration of Independence. Historian Gordon Wood at Brown University says the Declaration was a message to the world.
They are trying to, I think, signal to the world, we are a new nation, we've broken away from this other nation, we're a separate nation, and we want recognition of our independence.
The Declaration of Independence begins with these words.
When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation.
The Declaration goes on to say,
we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government.
The British believed that the Americans were violating British law. Jefferson argued that the British treatment of the American colonies violated the natural laws of God. This idea of natural law had been expressed by British and French philosophers more than 100 years earlier. Jefferson had studied these philosophers in school, but in writing the Declaration of Independence, he said the words came straight from his heart. The Declaration goes on to list 27 complaints against the king. There are complaints against taxes without the consent of the colonists and against the presence of British troops in the colonies. After the list, Jefferson went on to write this statement.
That these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. That they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved. And that as free and independent states, they have the full power to levy war, conduct peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do.
Jefferson concluded the Declaration with a line that was meant to persuade the delegates to support the most serious step, revolution.
And for the support of this Declaration, with the firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor.
And that's our program for today. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Anna Mateo.